Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with writer Uri Kaufman. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I could continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. From just about any river to just about any sea these days, you'll hear so-called progressive protesters calling to globalize the Intifada. To be perfectly frank, there's nothing progressive about Intifada, despite what a mealy-mouthed Mom Donnie may try to publicly claim. Intifada is the Palestinian movement of violently murdering Israelis and Jews wherever they could find them. It's an open call for terrorism based on a centuries-old hatred of Jews in the West. Personal criticism of Israel's war on terror is legitimate in nature. Calling for the murder of any people on earth, yes, Jews included, is not. How is it that the so-called progressive left has been so consumed with anti-Semitic hatred and violence when they pride themselves on being the guardians of morality and decency? Today, writer Uri Kaufman and I will discuss his book, American Intifada: Israel, the Gaza War, and the New Anti-Semitism, where he examines this very question and provides some very provocative and often disturbing answers. In addition to American Intifada, Uri Kaufman is the author of 18 Days in October, The Yom Kippur War, and How It Created the Modern Middle East. So it was selected by the Financial Times in 2023 as one of the year's best history books. His work has appeared in Foreign Affairs, Newsweek, The Jerusalem Post, and numerous other publications. Kaufman lives in Lawrence, New York, with his wife and four children. Uri, thank you so much for meeting with me today. I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
Same here. Thank you.
So let's start this off. A Martian with a particular penchant for sociopolitical exceptionalism lands on Earth. It takes but a minute for him to download all the information he needs to understand the entire globe. What does he conclude?
Well, he concludes that planet Earth is a pretty strange place. He concludes that there's a group of people, the Jews, the Israelis, who should be the object of admiration for liberals and progressives everywhere. Israel is the only country in the history of the world founded by a labor union. It was the first country in the history of the world to have a woman rise to become the head of government without being related to a king or a male politician. Israeli women have always had the right to vote in the Zionist era as well, going back to even to the 1890s before women had the right to vote in America and Britain. Israel regularly appears at the top of every list in all the gay publications as one of the most friendly places on earth. The United States has never elected an openly gay man to the Senate. Israel elected its first openly gay man to the Knesset, the rough equivalent of the Senate, way back in, are you ready for this? December of 1973. And the big thing about it was that it wasn't a big thing. He sat in a government with the ultra-Orthodox. Nobody cared. It was fine. So you would think that Israel would be the country admired by liberals and progressives. And then on the other side of the ledger, you would think that the Arab world would be a target for progressive fury. A demographer was asked, what's the life expectancy of gay people in the Arab world? And he said, until they're discovered. Women don't seem to fare very well over there either. Minorities don't fare well. It's not a very liberal place. So why is it then that the progressives spring to the defense of the Arabs and the Palestinians in place of the Israelis? And I think the best way to understand it is by engaging in a thought experiment. So brief recap of October 7. Horrible attack, worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust. 1,200 people murdered, no justification, murdered in really, really hideous ways. Babies were put into microwave ovens and burned to death, things like that. Many, many women were raped. 251 hostages. The attack enjoyed universal support among the Palestinian public, according to every poll. Palestinians regularly refer to Jews as apes and pigs. If you don't believe me, go on Google, type in Jews, apes, and pigs, or Palestine, apes and pigs. You scroll with your mouse, you'll see dozens of quotes. One last fact. The Biden administration budgeted billions of dollars of aid for Gaza, not for Hamas, of course, but for what they term the innocent civilians. Okay, let's assume every one of those facts is true. Let's just change one fact. Let's assume the invaders on October 7 are not Arabs. Let's assume they're Germans of another era, or I don't know, Ukrainians of another era, or white South Africans. In other words, white people, not people of color. Do you really think that Biden would have budgeted billions of dollars to the white supremacists who say Jews are apes and pigs? And now hold the thought. Let's carry the thought experiment all the way through. Let's assume, again, in this parallel universe, white supremacists, not Arab supremacists, but let's assume they murdered 1,200 black people and they raped black women. And then a Republican administration says, we're going to give billions of dollars of aid to the innocent civilians, the innocent white supremacists who say that blacks are apes and pigs. There'd be rioting in the streets. So, what's going on here? What's going on is, I think, a classic textbook case of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is a psychological phenomenon identified in the last century in which, when people have deeply held beliefs and then facts appear that contradict the beliefs, people change the facts. Not the beliefs. We all do this. Here we are. We have a not high profile, but highest profile conflict. It pits people of color against a perceived white group of privilege, the Jews. The progressives are going to side with the people of color because that is the way they are wired. Their highest value, core value, is fighting racism. So they're going to back the people of color. Now, the problem is the facts don't even remotely justify it. So that's when you get into the cognitive dissonance and they change the facts to fit the narrative. That's what's going on.
Yeah, it's enough to explode a Martian's brain. So yeah, meanwhile, back on Earth, we find ourselves in this severely inverted Orwellian reality wherein Israel, as you explain, one of the Earth's most thriving democracies, is uniquely and relentlessly condemned from all corners of the globe for really what turns out to be the most libelous in false accusations imaginable. Do you see this merely as a function of people of color versus perceived white, or is there something broader? Because this isn't the first attack ever that involves white people.
Well, so you raise a really good question. You're right. I mean, anti-Semitism comes in many shapes and sizes. I was trying to explain. You're right. There are some people who are just haters. Tucker Carlson is one. I think, say Zohran Mamdani is another. Dog whistling support for globalize the Intifada, things like that. There's no shortage of anti-Semites around the world. That's for sure. Also, look, let's be frank. Nations are driven by interests, not by justice. And until very recently, everybody perceived their interests as being in the Arab world. They have a lot of money, they have a lot of oil. But that's actually starting to change. And that's why you're starting to finally see nations soften. But just to end where we began, I was trying to identify a much stranger phenomenon. You know, the Tucker Carlsons of the world, the Candace Owens of the world, all right, that's one group of people. I know where I stand with them. Holocaust deniers, never debate a Holocaust denier. You're wasting your time. I was trying to explain people like, for example, Barack Obama. Barack Obama tweeted right after the October 7 attack that we have to face facts, he said. There's unclean hands on both sides. Whoa, why the moral equivalence? He said, because of what he termed the quote, unbearable occupation, unquote. Well, guess what? There was no occupation. Israel had withdrawn from Gaza over 18 years before with disengagement. So why is Barack Obama changing the facts to fit the narrative? It's what I just described. It's just a classic case of cognitive dissonance. Why does the New York Times regularly say things about Israel that are just patently false? For example, they said in the years leading up to the October 7 attack that even though Israel withdrew from Gaza, they were still an occupier. No, that's just ridiculous. How could you be an occupier if you're not even there? And that wasn't some crazy thing they said once or twice when the editor was on
Sure.
vacation. They said it literally in every story they did about Gaza. So there was one story, for
Yeah.
example, about how the mean Israelis wouldn't let Palestinian athletes travel across Israel to get to Europe for competitions. Well, why would they do that? They're at war. It's like saying, why wouldn't America let Germans travel across America to get to Japan in World War II? Or here was another one. The mean Israelis wouldn't share their COVID vaccines with Gaza. Well, why would they? We didn't share our COVID vaccines with ISIS, with the Taliban. We didn't share penicillin with the Nazis. You know, again, when you're an occupier, it might be one thing, but not when you've withdrawn. But that's the New York Times. Why are they changing the facts to fit the narrative? The New York Times also said, again, in the years leading up to the October 7 attack, that Israel was imposing a, quote, draconian blockade on Gaza. They used the word blockade over and over and over. So I looked up the numbers. What is the draconian blockade? In the last full year before the October 7 attack, 2022, Israel supplied Gaza with 5.7 billion gallons of water, without which they would have died of thirst. 67,000 trucks filled with supplies, two-thirds of Gaza's electricity, all of its fuel. Now they got to pay for this. So 17,000 Gazan Palestinians had license to work in Israel and bring home a paycheck. It would be like America letting, I don't know, 17,000 North Koreans work in America so that we could send supplies to Pyongyang. We don't let North Koreans work here today, even when there's a ceasefire. So, I mean, to call that a blockade is ridiculous, but the New York Times said it over and over. That's the phenomenon I was trying to describe.
Yeah, I would say that an even more apt analogy would be for South Korea to have North Koreans come. For Gazans to come to America is actually a different analogy because the dynamic between Israel and Gaza or the Palestinians, including Judea and Samaria, is it when you have someone on your border, it changes everything. And obviously, this is something that South Korea, and it amazes me when I hear South Koreans who are also against Israel because I'm like, do you not understand? The amazing thing is that this poison has become like so infused in the bloodstream of the world that people can't even draw the simplest parallels. Now you refer to this current era as being characterized by a new anti-Semitism. So I want to know, like, when do you see the actual inflection point from the old anti-Semitism to the new semi anti-Semitism? I mean, did it start with Jimmy Carter? Was it a different place? But also, more importantly, what distinguishes good old-fashioned traditional anti-Semitism from what you would term new anti-Semitism?
So I can't really point to like an inflection point when I can say, ah, that was the moment when, you know, oh, now it changed. I think it's been morphing in this direction in kind of a creeping way for a long, long time. Certainly, if you want, you could look at Jimmy Carter as one of the really important milestones. Jimmy Carter was a guy who got to go into politics because he was independently wealthy. The reason he was independently wealthy was his family owned a plantation. The reason they owned a plantation was, and he writes about this in his memoir, his great-great-grandfather, Wiley Carter, bought the land for a song from the guy who got it from, who stole it from the Indians. The Indians were thrown out in something called the Trail of Tears. It was done by Andrew Jackson, who was, of course, on the $20 bill in the Indian Removal Act of 1830. They sent them to Oklahoma, which was a desert, and 90% of them were killed. I mean, it's about as close as America came to actually committing genocide. And Jimmy Carter always felt really guilty about that. He felt guilty about Jim Crow. And he writes about this. He always identified the Palestinians with the black people and the Indians and the Jews with the white people. Now, again, if we were talking about apartheid and Jim Crow and things like that, I find a lot of common ground with the Jimmy Carter. It's just that these things have literally nothing whatsoever to do with Israel. It's just a completely different fact pattern. And see, that's really what I was trying to describe. What makes it different is in this era, I mean, we all know where, you know, a Hitler was, where, you know, I can say the 19th century anti-Semites, of which there was no shortage, the pogroms in Ukraine. I mean, it was just driven by hate. This is driven, you know, in many ways by the best of intentions. They're just overcorrecting on race, and it's driven largely just by straight up ignorance and people who really should know better. And who otherwise in other spheres of life would be considered, you know, I think very good, fine people. And by the way, I have a lot of admiration for Barack Obama. He's, you know, everything I admire. He's a self-made man. He seems to be, you know, a very good family man. He didn't have any scandal around him. I mean, I'd have political differences with him, but in any respect, I would consider him a man to admire. But again, we all do this. We all engage in cognitive dissonance. And it's just natural when you think it's the hardest thing for us humans to do is to think outside our box. And when your box is one driven by race and you're used to springing to the defense of people of color against white people, your natural instinct is going to be to spring to the defense of the Palestinians. Now, if you get educated like a Richie Torres, like a Van Jones, like a John Fetterman, you're going to realize that it's a complete absurdity. But a lot of people just don't seem to have that capacity.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of reasons for that that I do want to get into, but I first would like to get into some presidential stuff. So in your book, you do basically begin the discussion, which what I would term executive anti-Semitism, meaning U.S. presidential anti-Israel policies based on double standards, which are by default and by definition anti-Semitic. So it's not the kind of anti-Semitism that the man on the street thinks of as anti-Semitism. People have to understand double standards are anti-Semitic when the only state that can possibly be guilty of a particular offense happens to be Jewish. That's anti-Semitic. Now, this phenomenon, it seems, began with Jimmy Carter. I'm way too young to know Ford or anything before that, so maybe you can enlighten me. Your book again does start with Jimmy Carter as its springboard, and then it threads through, honestly, Democratic and Republican administrations alike, which is also disturbing, in the 5 decades leading up to today. So what do you think it was about the 1970s, also the same decade in which the infamous Zionism is racism resolution was passed at the United Nations? So what was it about the 1970s and about President Carter that created the conditions for this really insidious and institutionalized anti-Semitism?
It's not easy to understand. And I mean, just to go back to your first point, you made a really good point that a double standard is anti-Semitism. So I always say it's not really a double standard, it's actually a triple standard. The standard applied to the Arabs, to let's say the Vladimir Putins, which is to say no standard at all. There's the standard applied to the democracies and to the Barack Obamas and David Camerons. And then there's that special set of rules applied to Israel, only Israel, no one but Israel. And when you do that, I mean, here's a perfect example. When we went to war with Islamic State, it was President Obama who initiated that. It's called Operation Inherent Resolve. We didn't supply any humanitarian assistance at all. We besieged cities. Section 5.20 of the U.S. Army Law of War Army Manual says, quote, starvation is a legitimate method of warfare, unquote. Now, that's not just words on a page. That is policy. There was an article in the Huffington Post in April the 29th, 2016, which described the American siege of Fallujah. We besieged it. This was Barack Obama. By the way, it was also David Cameron. In Operation Inherent Resolve, America supplied 70% of the air power, Britain 20%, and then Canada, Australia, France, the other 10%. So we have a perfect statement of all the enlightened nations of the world, and we starved them out. The article described how, at that moment in 2016, 140 people had already been starved to death in Fallujah. The rest of the city was making soup out of grass. The reporter asked Obama's White House press secretary, Josh Earnest, to comment. He didn't deny it, to his credit. He said, look, it's war is hell, that we're facing a tough situation, and this is what you got to do to win. And I have to say, I agree. You know, the way to save lives is to win the war. It's to make sure that the Islamic states of the world don't have countries to run. But here's the question: how can it be that Barack Obama supplies no humanitarian assistance whatsoever, legal, moral, ethical, proportional, everyone's fine with it. Netanyahu supplies 2 million tons of food, and that's genocide. And every single night, it seems like Christiane Amanpour has some other guest, I don't know where she finds them, the professor from Vermont, the member of the House of Lords, the so-called human rights advocate, everyone has the same conclusion, it's genocide. How can that be? It's senseless. Or here's another one. Obama deliberately bombed the main hospital in Mosul.
I do want to get into all of these specifics, but first I do want to talk about what was it about the 70s? Why? What changed? What was it that went from a nation in a world that really did support the Jewish state as this tiny Davidian miracle. And then something switched. And it became okay to not just support them, but to actually get aggressive against them.
Well,
Can
for starters, it's the world has always been a very hard place on Israel. Let's be clear about that. Israel, even in the 60s and the 70s, it was driven by something else. It was driven by interests. It was driven by the fact that the Arabs had oil and the Jews didn't. It was as simple as that. That's why the 70s was such a tough time. I'm old enough to remember the oil lines from the Arab oil embargo in 1973. That was a really tough time. And if you want to go back, I mean, in 1979, forget about Zionism is racism. The UN actually condemned Israel for signing a peace treaty with Egypt, if you can believe that. General Assembly Resolution 3470, the Secretary General of the UN, the Security Council, Kurt Waldheim, condemned Israel for rescuing hostages in Entebbe, if you can believe that. Maybe he thought they should give the hostages back to the terrorists. I don't know. I mean, these are things that happened. What I do think changed was, for whatever reason, the 1960s was an era in which the world finally came to grips with racism. A lot of really good things happened. America's system of apartheid finally was dismantled. It was a beautiful thing. In the 1970s, we see Rhodesia finally going away. It took a little longer for South Africa, but it happened. People became more sensitive to race. And as is, humans are wont to do, I think people overcorrected. At least a lot of people did. Not everybody, but a lot of people, again, look at this highest profile conflict. You got people of color, they're fighting a white group of privilege. And if you don't know the history and you're ignorant, and frankly, how many people know Israeli history? For most people, Israel is a Hebrew-speaking Portugal. I don't know anything about Portuguese history myself. So, how would you know that the Jews immigrated to Palestine legally? They were invited to come. How would you know that the Jews bought land from the Arabs? They didn't steal it. They didn't throw people off their property as Jimmy Carter's ancestors did. They paid for it. Studies have been done. The Jews were paying $1,000 an acre at a time in the 1920s. When farmland in Nebraska and Iowa was going for $100 an acre, they're paying 10 times as much. Now, I'm not faulting the Palestinians. We all know what's valuable in real estate: location, location, location. And if Jews thought that swamp and desert in Palestine was worth 10 times as much as fertile farmland in Nebraska, then it was worth 10 times as much. But having immigrated there legally, having bought the land, where's the complaint? Where Jimmy Carter talks about how what happened in Israel was the same thing that my ancestors did to the Indians. He writes this in one of his memoirs. It's ridiculous. It is
Yeah.
absurd. But, again, it's just very hard to fight against cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. I'd also like to, I know you're not saying it because you believe it, but some people who may be listening who don't understand the air quotes of a white group of privilege, that the Jews are neither white nor privileged. We in fact are the most oppressed group in the history of the world. We have fought hard and built our own success instead of wallowing in our ashes. Likewise, as you know, but many people don't, more than 50% of all Israeli Jews are people of color. So, even these notions of when we talk about falsehoods, they go so deep that this is a pit that knows no bottom. But I do want to get back into what you were saying about all the hypocrisy. In fact, you label it in your book, I love it, you call President Biden's Operation Hypocrisy as this just really mind-boggling Middle East policy that was characterized by such wild double standards and in unimpeachable cognitive dissonance. So if you want to give some of the examples of the blatant hypocrisy, particularly again, going back to Mosul, Fallujah, bombing aid convoys, hospitals, weddings, the list goes on.
Yeah, well, it really is. And just remember this: Joe Biden was, of course, Obama's vice president, and all the senior people in his administration, like Antony Blinken, he was undersecretary of state. You could go down the list. General Austin was this secretary of defense. I'm having a senior moment here. He was commander of CENTCOM. Just go down the list. They were all there in the Obama administration. So when you look at the way America waged war against Islamic State. I'm going to preface by saying they didn't do anything wrong. For example, Obama deliberately bombed the main hospital in Mosul. It's called the Salem Hospital. It was nothing but a smoking wreck. You can see a picture of it. It's online. The Associated Press took a picture. We just blew it up. Now, Article 19 of the Geneva Convention says black on white that you're allowed to do that. If it's being used for military purposes, as ISIS did, you are allowed to bomb it, and we did. Okay, so Israel, by contrast, when it came to the Shifa Hospital in Gaza, gave warning, gave up the element of surprise, sent in ground troops, moved the patients out, preserved the physical plant of the facility, fought running gun battles, including in the pediatric ward. Okay, that's genocide. Okay, how can this be? It's craziness. We killed 40,000 civilians just in Mosul, only one battle. That, according to Iraq's Foreign Minister Hashyar Zebari, who was from Mosul. Okay, we killed 40,000 in just one battle. We only took two killed in the whole battle of Mosul. Mosul, by the way, is a city almost as big as, actually a little bigger than Philadelphia. Over 1.3 million people. It's huge. We leveled it because we didn't send in ground troops, and we killed 40,000 civilians. And that was only one battle. It was Ramadi, Raqqa, all these other places. And again, everyone was fine with it. Legal, moral, ethical, proportional. No one said one word of protest. Israel sends in ground troops. They've killed a fraction of the civilians. Even if you accept the nonsense Palestinian numbers, everyone is screaming that it's genocide. Here's another example. You will remember in the war, an Israeli convoy accidentally fired upon an aid car and killed seven workers. It was a horrible tragedy. And the Israelis apologized and they paid compensation. They did the things you do when these things happen. And everyone's saying, now we need a ceasefire. Okay. I believe it was October of 2015, American fighter jets accidentally bombed a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan, in Kunduz, killed 42 people, 42 doctors and patients. Again, a hideous tragedy. They bombed the wrong building. These things happen. It's a terrible thing when it does. We apologize. We paid compensation. Nobody said, that's it. War is over. You killed civilians. Now we got to stop. You got to let the Taliban win. The whole thing is craziness. You could go down the line. With one thing after the other after the other, David Cameron again was very critical of Israel as Rishi Sunak's foreign secretary. When he was prime minister, we were doing all these things with Islamic State, and I needn't tell you, Islamic State posed a far smaller threat to America than Hamas did to Israel, and it was an identical campaign. The campaign was to make sure that ISIS not control Islamic State. Israel's war, of course, to make sure Hamas not control Gaza. We went to war at a time when fewer than 100 Americans had been killed by ISIS on American soil, probably even fewer Englishmen on British soil. And yet we allowed ourselves to do all these things, which I stress again are legal under international law. Well, they're legal when we do it. They're legal when Obama does it. They're legal when David Cameron does it. But when Benjamin Netanyahu does even less, well, that's genocide. I mean, there's just something wrong with this.
Let me add to that list about ISIS that not a single person started a resolution in the UN to grant ISIS an actual state. There's that as well. The level of lunacy, again, this Martian, his head is exploding. By the way, the reason I keep coming back to the Martian for anyone who's listening is it is the opening of the book because you have to have that blink mind to be able to see the world for what it is, because of cognitive dissonance, we all see everything through our own colored glasses. But Uri, I want to ask a question specifically about Biden, actually. Biden is a self-described Zionist. In having personally been a part of AIPAC for more than 20 years, I could tell you I actually do agree. He didn't win any political points by saying repeatedly that he's a Zionist. So why would he, of all people, be a party to all these blatant double standards?
The answer is that for all his statements about being a Zionist, the fact of the matter is he and the members of his administration, and a lot of them have given interviews since, there's a guy named Milan Goldenberg, there's that guy Amos Hochstein, they have very mixed feelings about this conflict. And they wanted a mixed outcome to match those mixed feelings. So that is why they pressured Israel not to go into Rafah. Now, Rafah is right on the boundary where Gaza meets the Sinai Peninsula, which is, of course, Egyptian controlled. So that's where all the weapons were being flooded in. And it was obvious to anyone that for Israel to win this war and make sure another attack not happen, you're going to have to cut off the flow of weapons coming in from Sinai. So of course Israel had to go into Rafah. Well, the Biden administration pressured Israel not to do that. And luckily Netanyahu defied them, and he went ahead and he did it anyway. And that's why Israel, one of the reasons why Israel ultimately won the war. But that's just one example of where the Biden administration was pressuring Israel in effect, to let, again, to have this kind of indeterminate outcome. It's not that they wanted Israel to lose, but they didn't really want Israel to have a decisive victory either. Again, they wanted a mixed outcome to match their mixed feelings. You might remember that in July of 2024, Israel managed to kill a leading Hamas terrorist named Mohammed Def. And that staggered Hamas. And for the first time, they started to soften in the negotiations. But then at the end of the month, Kamala Harris, who was then by then the candidate, gave a speech where she said, "There's too much suffering. I won't allow this. Israel has to stop. How Israel defends itself matters," and so on. And that's when Hamas walked away from the table, because they said, "Look, let's see how the election turns out. If Kamala wins, she's going to make sure we win the war." There is no way Israel could have attacked Iran if Kamala had won the election. It just wouldn't have happened.
Oh,
And that's
yeah.
another example, by the way. If we could just another perfect thought experiment, okay? Iran says it's run by a bunch of crazy Ayatollahs. They say Jews are apes and pigs. They say that because there's a verse in the Quran that says it, by the way. And if you don't believe me, again, type in Ayatollahs, apes, and pigs on Google. Scroll with your mouse. You'll see what I'm saying is true. So imagine you've got, they say Jews are apes and pigs. They want to commit genocide. They got a clock ticking in Tehran. When they're going to blow Israel off the map, even the supposed moderates in Iran say Israel is a one-bomb country. Okay, so now let's assume all those facts are true, but let's just change one fact. Let's assume that Iran was run not by crazy Ayatollahs who say Jews are apes and pigs, but crazy white supremacists who say blacks are apes and pigs. Okay, do you really think that Obama would have signed an Iran deal with that country? An Iran deal that says they get to keep the first generation centrifuges, they can continue the research, they get to research weaponizing, putting a nuclear warhead on a missile, which everyone says is the hardest part. They can make weapons in 5 years, missiles in eight, enrich uranium in 10, 15 years go by, the whole deal sunsets. And the experts debate, will the breakout period be a few weeks, maybe a few months? In the meantime, they get over $100 billion to fund insurgencies killing black people because they say blacks are apes and pigs. Do you really think he would have signed a deal like that? Of course not. But it's people of color and they're fighting the Jews. So now you get into cognitive dissonance. Well, said Obama, they're going to use that $100 billion to improve the lives of the Iranian people, which is laughable. And everyone who knows anything about Iran must have told him that was ridiculous. You convince yourself of things that otherwise you wouldn't, because again, the Iranians are the people of color. He's probably still thinking about that coup in 1953 as if it's all our fault, which, by the way, is ridiculous. And again, the Jews are the white group of privilege. So you start to justify things, and before you know it, you have an Iran deal.
Boom. Okay. You are a bash of knowledge. I have to say, what surprised me about your book was I thought I was picking up a book primarily about anti-Semitism, but quite frankly, it's very rife with historical references. And anybody who reads this will understand so many things from the Nuremberg trials to the war in Gaza to all the topics that were going, the Iran nuclear talks, to everything. So it's a very, very comprehensive overview. I do want to focus more on the social dynamics of this new anti-Semitism as much as possible, because it is just such a unique dynamic at a very disturbing time. But coming back to, you mentioned this before, Barack Obama's "both sides have dirt on their hands" quote. A bizarre in again, very, I hate to overuse the word disturbing, but the world today is so disturbing. It was a very disturbing response to October 7th. It exposed the vast hypocrisy of the left that to this day hangs its flag on vilifying Trump for allegedly saying there were fine people on both sides in Charlottesville. No irony there. Particularly because it's a well-known fact that Trump's quote was taken out of context. It was not even referring to neo-Nazis as being among the fine folks. Yet, there's no confusion at all who Obama was referring to as both sides. This was a statement explicitly defending the Hamas terrorists and tacitly justifying the the barbaric atrocities that they committed. I can't comprehend how, in particularly in post 9/11 America, for those of us who are old enough to remember 9/11, that we've even have one leader who would dare to condone Islamic terror anywhere on earth, much less this strong and growing coalition of leaders in tens, if not hundreds, of millions of followers around the world. Do you think that 9/11 was somehow like a catalyst rather than a deterrent of this philo-Islamicism that seems to be largely fueling the global pandemic of Jew hatred?
Well, I think it was what is referred to by pollsters as a polarizing event. I think it hardened beliefs, I can say actually on both sides. Certainly it gave us it brought Islamic radicalism home to Americans in a way that Americans had never felt before. It's one thing to read about, even attacks in Europe or attacks in Israel. It's another to see a plane flying into a building. And I actually saw one of the buildings come crashing down. Just standing on Fifth Avenue. On the other side of the equation, though, if you go back in time, there were progressives like, for example, Susan Sontag, who said we had it coming to us. So did Noam Chomsky. Said, we have it coming to us. This is the result of our policies, they said. It's ridiculous. Now, again, stop for a moment and ask yourself, what if the hijackers had been members of the Irish Republican Army? Okay, and bear in mind, we've always sided with Britain against the IRA. Do you really think they would have said that? Or the Bader-Meinhof gang. In other words, if they'd have been white people, do you really think they would have said, "Well, we brought it on ourselves. We did this." Of course not. It's ridiculous. So again, I do think it was kind of a polarizing event. The whole thing can be a little bewildering if you're on our team and you're looking at this and you're wondering why otherwise responsible people say things that are just completely nonsensical. Well, here's another one: Amnesty International. I went on their search bar in May of 2024 and I typed in the word rape. 2,632 entries came back. Okay, rape in Darfur and rape in South America and rape in Russia, rape in every corner of planet Earth. Just one place never came up. You guessed it, Israel. Now, bear in mind, by then, May of 2024, several Israeli women had already courageously stepped forward and said they'd been raped. Two Hamas terrorists were admitted to a confessed on tape, on video that was released, saying they had raped people. And the UN, which is not exactly known for its pro-Israel sympathies, had issued a report the previous November saying that there'd been mass rape. But Amnesty International didn't recognize it. Now, I thought this can't be. So I went back and typed in Hamas rape. And only one hit came back. It was a Palestinian woman claiming Israelis had threatened her with rape. So, it's obvious here that Amnesty International, they have this halo of a human rights organization, but the fact is it's a progressive values advocacy group. They take sides. And, part of being a progressive values advocacy group is siding with people of color. And that's what they do. Human Rights Watch did it today. Its founder, a guy named Bob Bernstein, said Human Rights Watch is not a human rights organization. It's an anti-Israel advocacy group. They view that as their core mission. They say things about Israel that are just nonsensical. And it really is a sad commentary. But the good news is there is a silent majority that stands with us. I really do believe that. I think we see that over and over. We see that certainly now with President Trump in power. And overall, I do think we can reach these people just by confronting them with their biases.
Well, I want to discuss way later, not now, the As a Jew Jews, but I only want to bring it up right now for just to make the point that Sontag, Chomsky, and Bernstein are all Jewish. So this is a disgrace upon a disgrace. Another thing that's very interesting to me, to tell you the truth, is that at again, the broad cognitive dissonance that the same marauding mobs who insist there were no massacres, rapes, or atrocities on 10/7 simultaneously support that these atrocities occurred. Like there's no way, there's literally no way to square these circles. It's just remarkable mental gymnastics to to do anything possible to literally just vilify the Jews. I would can't characterize what we see today, like 2025. I believe your book, because of the last line, came out in, or was finished written in January of this year. And
It was.
I would, huh?
Yeah, it was. Sorry to cut
Yeah.
you off.
I'd say what a difference a year makes. I think that what we're seeing like today, taking what I read in your book, is a new anti-Semitism that has explicitly turned not just on the Jewish state, but in fact on the whole Jewish people. Like people, Jews in LA and New York and Sydney and London, who have nothing to do with Israel, nothing to do with Gaza. This isn't about Gaza. It pretends to be about Gaza. This whole farce is so evilly constructed. Yes, anti-Semitism is this constantly morphing virus, as Jonathan Sacks said, but what is it that has laid the conditions for it to morph so dangerously to this Nazi level and truly genocidal fervor?
Well, first of all, you made a really good point before. You know, when Russia invaded Ukraine, nobody accosted Russians on campus. Nobody said,
Right.
nobody protested in front of them or the Russian Orthodox Church or anything. It was like, yeah, well, that's over there. What's it got to do with these people over here? But somehow the Jews, are the only ones who carry a target on their back. It is kind of weird. I do think social media has a lot to do with it. Social media and cognitive dissonance were made for each other. Cognitive dissonance was identified by a psychologist named Leon Festinger in the previous century. And he said that what makes it work, what makes it happen, you find it when, number one, people invest heavily in a certain set of beliefs. And number two, when there are other people who believe in like-minded beliefs, so that when it all turns out to be false, you still have other people from whom to draw emotional support. And government policy, it's long been noted, is just perfect for cognitive dissonance. Simply put, no one in politics ever admits they made a mistake. And that's why governments always double down when they make a mistake. A woman named Barbara Tuchman wrote a classic called The March of Folly, describing exactly this phenomenon where it was just self-evident, for example, that the Vietnam War was a mistake, but they doubled down. King George III doubled down on the American Revolution when it was self-evident that it cost far more to fight the war than whatever he would have gotten from his taxes, and so on and so on. Now that we have social media, I don't care what you believe. You could be a flat earther. There's going to be some like-minded group of people that you can get on the internet with and commiserate with, so that every time, for example, a fact comes out, saying that, for example, Hamas raped Israeli women. And by the way, there was a study recently that said it was probably a lot more widespread than people realized because they covered it up by mutilating the bodies. There's still going to be people on the internet, on social media, saying, "Ah, oh, no, it didn't really happen. It's all fake news. It's all false." And here we are.
Yeah. So I want to get your take on like why do you think that these new anti-Semites and especially on social media, to be honest, weaponize such specific and triggering words such as genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid in their strategy against the Jews?
Well, apartheid is obvious because it mobilizes imageries of racism, which is that's the hot button issue. That's what gets people's juices flowing, and that's what they're fighting. And sadly, you mentioned the Aza Jews, but there's a lot of people there because think about it for a moment. A lot of Jews who don't have a very strong Jewish background define their Judaism by what is now referred to as Tikkun Olam. And Tikkun Olam, it's basically a bunch of liberal talking points. And look, I'm kind of center right. I mean, we can argue, things like healthcare all day long, but the fact is, when you define your Judaism as a bunch of liberal talking points, the number one liberal priority, the core value, the one that crowds out all the others, is of course fighting racism. So now think about this for a moment. They've come up with a construct, Tikkun Olam, that defines Judaism in a way that demonizes Jews, because again, we're the white group of privilege. So, this is how you end up with these completely bizarre outcomes. And I have to say, wherever I speak, I get this all the time. There's going to be an older person who raises their hand during the Q&A and says, I've got a grandchild that hates Israel and hates Jews. How did this happen? And what can I do about it? This is how it happened. What we can do about it, I think, is just by confronting people and by engaging them and by using thought experiments to challenge people and their beliefs. And like, does it really make a difference what the people's skin color is? We're supposed to judge people not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. By that measure, are you really doing the right thing? And you'd be surprised. I get quite a few people who think for a moment and say, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. Well, okay. So apartheid is definitely in a league of its own. It's just a, it's, I only mention it because it's sort of a third rail. So the choice of words like genocide and ethnic cleansing are not random. They do this on purpose, the same reason that they, like in BB to Hitler and the IDF to Nazis. This is very, very deliberate. Why do you think they're doing this?
So Niall Ferguson, it's a good question, but Niall Ferguson, the great historian and professor, said that, look, I know academia, he said, really well, been doing it my whole life. All right. There is no way that immediately after the October 7 attack, all these elite colleges just spontaneously came together around a message of genocide and war crimes and apartheid, and all of them had the same color tent. There does seem to, I mean, I can't prove anything, but it really does look like there was some sort of a coordinated effort, maybe with Qatari money behind it, maybe something else, maybe Saudi money behind it. I don't know, but it seems pretty clear that there was a coordinated effort. They probably, they thought this through very carefully. They might have even focus grouped it. I don't know, but there seems to be little doubt that the people who went to war with Israel in the information sphere knew the messages they wanted to hit, knew the points that were going to get people up, riled up and get people going. And also, I have to say another thing. People have psychologically a tendency to project their own thoughts onto others. Everyone kind of knows Hamas says itself it wants to commit genocide. So now you flip the script and you say, well, it's really the Israelis committing genocide, which again, it's an absurdity. Obama starved cities, it's legal, and Netanyahu supplies 2 million tons of food. That's genocide. It's craziness.
Well, I think it comes back to the same, not to overuse a phrase, cognitive dissonance, that if they can blame the Jews for the worst possible things that they could think of, then all of a sudden it's okay for them to condemn the Jews. Because if, God forbid, we were actually the victims of these genocides that we in pogroms and in all of the attacks that we actually have been subjected to throughout the centuries, then all of a sudden it proves that we are not in fact the oppressor, and that really crosses their wires. One of the most confounding aspects, honestly, of like new anti-Semitism is that even as people, going back to your social media concept, like post the most vile and cruel anti-Semitic content on social media, even as they shriek in the streets to globalize the Intifada and destroy the one and only Jewish state, they scramble to deny their anti-Semitism or to be, God forbid, labeled as actual anti-Semites. I mean, how many times has Mamdani, who's, the poster boy of everything we're talking about, tried to make nice with the Jews or say, oh, I have nothing against the Jews. I mean, I just want the complete destruction of the Jewish state and I'll do anything to accomplish it. But I love the Jews. Why do you think it is that people who exhibit zero compunction about their aggressive Jew hatred are so desperate not to be called anti-Semites?
Well, obviously, in this day and age, there are certain proprieties that have to be adhered to. You can't be a racist in America in the 21st century. And that's why whenever you see these protests, they always have an as a Jew, an in-house person say, well, and I'm Jewish and I agree with everything we're doing because now it makes it okay. I listened to a podcast by Michael Moore, who's very firmly, obviously, in the progressive camp, and
Yeah.
started out talking, gave this homily to the Jewish labor organizers of the 1930s who gave up comfortable jobs in places like New York City and Boston as lawyers to come out to the Midwest and take jobs in factories as auto workers, doing menial tasks in many cases, so that they could organize the workers into labor unions. And he went off how wonderful they are. And, but then he finished and he immediately shifted gears and started attacking Israel in ways that were just ridiculous. He was comparing it to George Floyd. He said, George Floyd times 7 million, that's the Israel power. It's ridiculous, nonsense. So, he felt the need to be able to say, aha, see, I'm not an anti-Semite. I'm praising the Jewish labor organizers. Or here's another thing, when this is one of the ways to distinguish between, I'll say, the old anti-Semites, paleo anti-Semites, and the new anti-Semites. When white supremacists attack Jews, like, for example, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, all the people who hate Israel went, I mean, were stumbling all over themselves to condemn it as, I mean, to condemn it as a horrible attack, of course, but I always felt like on some level they were saying, see, I'm not an anti-Semite. Look,
Right.
I'm condemning violence against Jews, but that's because the Tree of Life attack was done by a white man. So it was right in the wheelhouse. If it's a white man, it's right in the narrative of evil white people committing acts of racism. When it's a person of color doing it, there was such an attack in upstate
Right.
New York, in Spring Valley. It was a machete wielding guy, and then and it turned out he was an African American, and they were saying, well, there's been a lot of tension lately. The Orthodox Jews have taken over the public school board, and well, the guy was mentally disturbed, and all sorts of things. Suddenly, there's a need to soften it. That's where you see this cognitive dissonance working. That's why, again, in the New York Times, I talk about it in the book. When terrorists are white people, they tend to call them terrorists, whether it's the IRA or the Bader-Meinhof gang. When they're people of color, they're militants, they're extremists. Once in a while, they'll even call them commandos, if you can believe that. But they don't usually call them terrorists. Once in a blue moon, they will. But it's very unusual. And again, it fits in with that narrative. This happened with Christian Amanpour. There was a rabbi who it was really tragic. There was he lost his wife and two of his daughters. They were just massacred driving on a highway in Israel by a Palestinian terrorist, and Christian Amanpour described it as a shootout. Now, a shootout is what happened at the OK Corral when the bullets are flying in both directions. This was just a massacre. And she, after the outcry, she did apologize for it, but she did this again when she talked about the suffering. Oh, I don't even remember what it was, but she was saying the suffering of the hostages alongside the starvation of the Palestinians. In other words, if just feeling a need to soften the blow when we're talking about people of color, you see this over and over. And this again is one of the things that distinguishes, I think, the new anti-Semitism. When white people do it, they're fine with condemning it. When people of color do it, then the cognitive dissonance starts to kick in.
And again, these media examples, they never end. I mean, we've got like memory and camera, honest reporting. We have so many media watchdogs that literally their whole thing 24/7 is dealing with all of these media perversions that really fill. I believe that the media, in addition to social media, are just as responsible for creating this narrative in the world. Because like you said in the book, today you said Portugal, but in the book you say, Israel might as well be Denmark. Nobody really knows anything about Israel. So we can't all know everything about everything. So if all you know is what you hear on the nightly news and CNN insists that there's an occupation and a genocide and all the things, of course you're going to be outraged. And it's so this is a nonstop cycle. But I just want to circle back for 1 second to this just this concept of not wanting to be called anti-Semitic when being so blatantly anti-Semitic. I mean, we live in this world where like a person can be punished literally for aggressive pointing, which happened, I think, at Harvard. And the DSA recently warned about wearing aggressive scents in their latest meeting or whatever. And yet, like unmitigated Jew hatred and even absolute violence against Jews isn't just condoned, but actually celebrated by these same people. Somehow, the anti-Semitic trend just slipped right under the no place for hate radar that seems to have taken over every other aspect of the entire world. And as I've pointed out in just about every episode of this podcast, the West seems utterly incapable of reckoning with the fact that throughout history, every society that has allowed itself to be consumed with Jew hatred has wound up consuming itself. Do you think that these social justice warriors, first of all, even recognize, I mean, because how much they rush to deny, do you think they recognize like how dark their souls have become when they are calling to literally murder Jews or defending people who kill Jews on the street or light them on fire? And like, do you see this tide of hatred receding before it drowns civil society as it always has in the past?
I'm a card-carrying optimist. You need to do what I do for a living. I am a card-carrying optimist. I do think, look, there are haters and they can't be convinced. And that's fine too. You're not going to convince everybody. There's this guy, Nick Fuentes. He's a hater. He's an anti-Semite. He's an old school, hardcore hater of Jewish people. And I can't do anything for, I can't help a guy like that. But what I think I can do and what I try to do is reach people who maybe are being anti-Semitic without even realizing it, who maybe don't understand that in their zeal to fight for social justice as they see it and fight for people of color. And I'll say it again, if we were talking about other contexts, you want to talk about the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and apartheid, I find a lot of common ground with these people. It's just that these things have literally nothing whatsoever to do with Israel and its plight, you know, beating back the Arab attempt to wipe it off the map. So I do think we can reach these people. I do think especially we can reach younger people. It's all just about getting people to confront their biases. Very often, you know, people get very angry when when they are forced to confront their biases. We all do this. Everybody does this. But I do think that people can be reached ultimately.
I've actually heard you say a number of times, not today, but in other podcasts, you refer to the Tentafada kids as quote unquote silly university students, and contend that they're not the real problem. I'd like to dig into that for a moment. There are a lot of problems with the mainstream anti-Semitism that's running rampant on our elite campuses, but quite frankly, on all our campuses. I could tell you, coming from Los Angeles, it's happening right here at Santa Monica City College, which is a community college. It's far from the Ivy League. So the fact that these silly students are actually a product of the educational system itself, I think, is the real problem. And I need to point out that indoctrination as education is exactly why we see the radicalized population that we do in Gaza. Why don't you think these young adults pose a real threat?
Well, because I'm a little alarmed to hear what you say about Santa Monica City College, but there are studies that have been done about this, and most of what we saw was just in seven elite universities. And there was a guy who did a study, I think his name was Mark Kotlikoff, and he found that as the tuition went down, the price of the tuition, in other words, went down, and as the quote unquote, you know, elite nature, let's say the SAT score went down, you found much, much, much less of this sort of thing. So we are talking about a relatively, I mean, admittedly, you know, an elite kind of high profile slice of the population. But let me give you a, you know, a good fact in the other direction. Europe has something called the Eurovision contest. And it's not very big in America, but it's huge in Europe. And it's a competition of different musical acts. And actually, it was the breakout for a lot of very famous acts like ABBA, like actually Olivia Newton-John, a bunch of others. Anyway, so the way they have the voting is first the public votes and then the judges vote. So this past year in 2025, the Israeli act came in number one among the public. Then the judges stepped in and they put Israel in 13th place. So the Israeli act didn't win the competition. Something similar happened last year in 2024. The Israeli act came in second in the voting out of everybody. Now, this is not, and again, the judges beat Israel down and made it come in a lower position. But the point is, there's no way this is a coincidence. I mean, the public does, on some level, get it. It understands what's going on here. It's just the elites, it's the judges, I can say in this instance, it's the elites who are so, I can say, obsessed with race. I mean, they do tend to tack to the left, And they're so obsessed with race that they've just blinded themselves to basic ideas like we judge people not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And when you start confronting people with things like, how can it be that Barack Obama bombed a hospital? It's legitimate. Netanyahu sent in ground troops. That's genocide. Or we kill far more civilians. It's legal, moral, ethical, proportional. Israel kills a fraction because, again, they took hundreds of dead, thousands of wounded. We just sent in our Air Force to blow them off the map. We use an Air Force to blow a country off the map. It's legal. Israel sends in ground troops to kill a fraction of civilians. That's genocide. This just doesn't make any sense. It's just ridiculous. I do think we can get through to people.
I assume that you are aware that that Gazan schools run by UNRWA indoctrinate their children from literally preschool to kill Jews wherever they could find them. Yes, you're aware of
PA
this.
does it also. There was just a story today in Times of
Right.
Israel. The PA, the Palestinian Authority, does
Yes.
the exact same thing. And
Yes, I agree, but my point being, one of the main things that needs to occur in order for Gaza to become citizens of the world is they need to be de-radicalized. The reason they need to be de-radicalized is because they've been indoctrinated. I believe you're looking at today's kids as you would look at the anti-Vietnam protests years ago before they had full force multipliers such as social media. These kids have been indoctrinated, this generation, since at least the last 10 to 20 years, with the woke baby starting all the way up through woke crimson. So I do believe this problem is way bigger. I don't see these kids, quite honestly, as going through a phase that they're going to grow out of, like all generations past. I'm going to go through a number of reasons, and then I'm going to ask you agree or disagree. Here are the reasons why I don't believe they're going to grow out of this. First and most importantly, past generations, again, did not have the force multipliers of social media, of mass legacy media, the way that they behave today, and institutional bias indoctrinating them with this visceral hate and resentment of Jews. Second, as our national leaders are getting younger and younger, as evidenced by people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and in Zohran Mamdani, these kids, these silly students are going to be controlling the country before they have time to grow out of their thinking, quite frankly. Third, as previously mentioned, ideological entrenchment has become so ironclad that very few people jump ship on their beliefs, even when presented with incontrovertible evidence to the contrary, cognitive dissonance, as we the buzzword of the day. Fourth, we're experiencing an unprecedented intergenerational trickle up of thoughts and values, wherein traditionally they've always trickled down. And fifth, the delegitimization of the Jewish state and the Jewish people was not an unfortunate byproduct of the October 7th massacres, but in fact was the overriding strategy of the entire Hamas campaign. And all of these kids are the usefully idiotic conduits of their efforts. Is there anything that I said that you would disagree with? It's okay if you do, of course.
I'm just not as pessimistic. There have been moments like this in the past where Israel dipped in terms of popularity. I think the worst one in my lifetime, well, first of all, it was back in the 70s because there was a real penalty in supporting Israel then, just given the fact that the Arabs had a chokehold on the global economy. That was a really, really difficult time for Israel, for Jews, any crazy resolution the Arabs wanted to pass in the UN, they were able to pass. And it wasn't just there. Also, just the left had a surge on campuses. It wasn't that much different. Also, after the massacre by Christian Falange of the Palestinians in Sabra Shatila in 1982, that was a really tough time as well. And it was reflected in the polling, but things did get back to normal. Now, you make a very good point. We have social media now that we didn't used to have. So now you do have this ability for people to reinforce their biases with like-minded people over the internet that we didn't have before. So that's a real problem. The flip side of it is that, look, that's a two-way street. And so people on the other side who are more pro-Israel have the same tools. They're using those tools, they're using them effectively, I think. Could the situation be better? It probably could. But I have to say, Israel enjoyed a measure of support in this war from American governments, and to a certain extent, even from Europeans, that it didn't have in the past. So, yeah, there's like a very, very vocal minority, but there's a silent majority too. Where it'll all fall out, it's really hard to say. But I will make one other point. People of my generation have done a terrific job keeping the memory of the Holocaust alive. I think any school child, and pretty much any school child, not just Jewish school child, knows what Auschwitz was, knows what the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising was. We've done a really good job on the Holocaust. We have done a terrible job educating kids about early Zionist history. And that is something where we really need to make a major focus. And especially in the yeshivas, in the day schools, you name it. Jewish kids, frankly, just don't know the first thing about early Israeli history, Zionist history. So they don't know things like the Jews immigrated there legally, or they bought the land, or the fact that they've always been there. So it wasn't, white people coming to a new world. It was a minority people becoming a majority people, which happens every now and again on planet. It happened in Northern Ireland, for example. I mean, these things happen. So, there's really nothing that a proud Zionist has to be ashamed of. I have never really heard a Palestinian argument that I found to be very persuasive. And I can even tell you, the probably the most eloquent spokesperson they ever had was a professor named Edward Said. He wrote a book called The Question of Palestine, and it was eagerly awaited. It came out in 1978 at a time when people were really desperate for that kind of content. And he didn't even focus on the history because he must have known on some level that that history just did not argue for the Palestinians. What he argued was, the Jews are white people, so they're racist. And if they're racist, then the Palestinians must be in the right. And it's just a nonsensical argument, but it's an emotional argument. So it has a lot of resonance for a slice of the electorate, but I think most people will see through it in the end.
Okay. You're talking about a book versus social media, wherein most children today, children, sorry, young people under 29 get most of their information from social media, and in particular TikTok, where there is I don't even know how many more times, 10, 20 more times anti-Israel propaganda than there is pro-Israel. We're not just up against propaganda, but we're up against disinformation and also AI. Just yesterday, I read a story about this new I don't even know what else to call it other than like a new take on the Elders of Zion, where they basically, in Arabic, they're claiming that there's a book written by Jews saying how they want to subvert the entire Muslim world. And it's a completely made up book, but because of AI, anybody could read and go, see, the Jews are planning on taking over the world. And first, they're going to kill all the Muslims. Second, I do want to point out that when you said that all our kids know about the Holocaust, I think you meant Jewish kids. Is that accurate? Because if you look at the actual statistics on high school and college kids and their Holocaust education, there's between 25 to 30% of American kids deny that the Holocaust existed or don't know that it existed. So the problem with Holocaust education, I don't expect Zionist education to go beyond the Jewish schools, but is that people are not aware of the Holocaust, so they can't really see this history repeating. And so these are again reasons that I think we are facing a very, very unique, and I'll make one more argument, Uri, which is the fact that we're 2 months into a ceasefire and the anti-Semitism is ramping up, not down, which goes to prove that this war, again, is a war of information, it more than it ever was a kinetic war. So there is nothing to imply that this they're going to stop putting fuel in the fire. They even, again, as the ceasefire drags on. There's no other word for it because Hamas is dragging their feet. They keep adding more and more fuel to the fire in why people need to hate Jews.
I mean, there's a lot of validity to what you're saying. There's no question. We got our work cut out for us. The social media part is going to be, without question, the hardest part. TikTok is a particularly bad actor in American public life, not just for Israel, but for many other things. It's obviously controlled by China. They say that the Chinese tilt the algorithm to do whatever causes the most dissent in America. So, the Chinese don't really care about Israel and the Palestinians, but they know that most Americans are pro-Israel, so they tilt the algorithm in favor of the Palestinians to create as much dissension as possible. I read it might be as much as 50 to 1 of the videos are tilted in favor of the Palestinians. Again, not because they care about the Palestinians, just because they know it's going to cause disruption in American political life, which is why I think President Trump is right. They've got to force TikTok to sell to an American company, or at least get out of Chinese hands, or just kick it out of the country. One other thing to keep in mind, there's talk about regulating algorithms, and I am very much supportive of that. An algorithm is not free speech, it's an algorithm, and it really should be made impossible to spread these lies in like a brush fire, or again, just to have a foreign actor take something just to disrupt people and create dissension and multiply that. There must be a way to prevent that just by attacking the algorithm. I mean, there's a lot of free speech purists who view that as impinging on the First Amendment. I don't see it that way. An algorithm is an algorithm, it's not free speech. So, but definitely, you are correct. We got our work cut out for us, no question.
Well, we have the additional threat of AI, which is a conglomerative search engine, basically, which takes everything that it can find all over the internet and conglomerates it into one narrative. The problem is that when we have bots propagating false narratives all across the internet, then AI starts picking up on that and does not distinguish between what is real and what is false. In fact, there was a big post today on Twitter that Grok has quite a few elements of Holocaust denial because it's picking up on the information that it's fed. This is a real danger. We're creating a machine that basically learns how to revise history even before it's written. So I think that modern technology is a real threat. If Larry Ellison buys TikTok, we're gonna have a new reality, just like Paramount. Did you see that Paramount has now made a counter boycott of the blatantly anti-Semitic actors and producers and writers and talent? Because now that it's also owned by Ellison or Ellison Jr. That they're going to, be fighting thus in if but I sort of laugh, but I don't want Jews of power to be our answer because that is exactly what cycles back into the old anti-Semitic tropes, but it may be, unfortunately, our only solution. I do want to mention before we wrap up something that we touched upon in the very beginning, which is the as a Jew, Jews. I don't know about you. I find this one of the most disturbing proxies of the new anti-Semitism. You have a whole chapter in your book about J Street with their quote unquote pro-Israel, pro-peace platform that gives these as a Jew Jews a certain political legitimacy. NGOs like B'Tselem in Israel give them social justice legitimacy, and legacy Israeli media like Haaretz give them historical legitimacy. And all of these like have paved the way for grassroots groups like Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now to revolt for their own demise. What is it about this suicidal new anti-Semitism that's so enticing to liberal Jews?
Again, I think it gets back to what I was talking about before. It's tikkun olam. It's when you define your Judaism as a bunch of liberal talking points, and one of those liberal talking points is fighting racism, which is, You've now elevated a liberal value to at the level of a religious conviction. And I can tell you, speaking as an Orthodox Jew, if you try to convince an Orthodox Jew that the world is more than 5,785 years old, you are likely to get an earful. I will point out that Maimonides, the Rambam, wrote his classic work, The Guide to the Perplexed, Mor Nebuchim, attacking this very phenomenon and writing in the 1100s. He said, the world is more than whatever, 4,000 years old than it was at the time. And as he laid down the law, when the interpretation of the Bible is conflicted by the facts, we change the interpretation, we don't change the facts. That's the message of the Talmud as well. Rabbi Judah the Prince, writing in like the year 200 CE, says in the Talmud, the Greek, we say, we Jews say that the sun revolves around what he called the firmaments of the heavens. The Greeks say the sun revolves around the earth. And then Rabbi Judah ends off, and the Greeks are probably right. Now, of course, they both got it wrong, but fair enough. But the point is, Rabbi Judah said what he did because it fit the words of the Bible, of the Torah, better than what the Greeks said. But then he looked at the evidence and said, no, but this is just wrong. And he was big enough to just admit the Greeks are probably right. How many people have the ability, like Maimonides, like Rabbi Judah the Prince, to think out of their box and say, no, wait a minute, the facts don't support what I believe, even though it's my deepest belief? I gotta shift gears. That is the Orthodox Jewish way. By the way, Maimonides' book was not well greeted by other Orthodox Jews. It was Rabbi Shlomo of Montpellier who organized the book burning in the 1100s. After Maimonides passed away, though, he publicly retracted what he said and did. He publicly asked for forgiveness. And that's the Orthodox Jewish way. We believe in facts, not just blind adherence to even to the most fervently held beliefs. I hope, and that is my wish, that others can figure out a way to think outside their box, focus on facts. And if they do that, then the pro-Israel community is going to get a lot larger.
From your mouth to God's ears, as they say in the old country. I could also, I don't really want to make a point of this, but the thing about the world's been around for billions of years, and there's no refuting that. To also say that time is a modern construct, and to say that God created all animals in a day might have been a billion years. We're trying to. It's just like the anthropomorphic. Physician, I can never say that word correctly, of God himself, that even to use the word him is a misnomer. He needs his own pronoun, but we could only think within what we understand. So that's how I'm going to go ahead and legitimize that the world has been around for billions of years. And I don't necessarily think that the Torah contradicts that, nor do I believe that evolution and creation are necessarily at odds either. The world was created and then we evolved. The end. So anyway, I don't really want to get into the
Well, I could
Talmudic
say
discussion.
Maimonides agrees. That's exactly what Maimonides says. So good for you. I mean, that has to be understood allegorically, and these things are not inconsistent. I agree with you completely. They're not inconsistent. But anyway.
Only because I have an event in a half an hour, I do need to wrap up this discussion. Uri, the way you end the book, the last two paragraphs of your book were just like a pièce de résistance. I loved it so much. I actually read the two paragraphs over and over because I just really loved them that much. I think it's a perfect ending to this conversation. Could you just read those last couple of paragraphs for us? And if you want, hold up the book. There's links to the book in the show notes for anybody who would like to purchase the book. It's American Intifada by Uri Kaufman. And in closing, help us out here.
Here goes, end of the book. And that's why I haven't given up on progressives either. The biases, the cognitive dissonance, these things will only last so long. Politics makes for strange bedfellows, as the old saying goes, but eventually people wake up and find themselves lying next to their enemy. That is, unless that enemy kills them first in their sleep. But like most Americans, I'm an optimist. So I'm going to end with a prediction. One day, those who share Israel's liberal values will look back upon our time. They will look back upon progressives who hate everything about Palestinians and Iranians except their struggle with Israel. They will look back at the tortured truths progressives employed to support this strange bias. and like racism itself, they will realize just how crazy the whole thing was. Amen.
You read that like the ending of a fairy tale.
Hopefully not a fairy tale.
No, amen and amen. Really beautifully summarized. I always ask my guests one last question before we wrap up. Uri, what does Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
Oh, what is Am Yisrael Chai? I'll tell you what it means. I was just in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts because I was doing a speaking gig in Massachusetts. And on the wall in the museum was a terracotta lion, okay, that was taken from the gates of the city of Babylon, okay? That very lion saw our ancestors brought in chains to Babylon in the year 586 BCE, over 2,600 years ago. On the rivers of Babylon, we sat and we cried. That is what it says in the Bible, okay? That very lion is looking upon Jews today, like me, like you, like anyone who comes in there, in a part of the world that no one then knew existed, in a wing of the museum funded by a Jewish philanthropist. Babylon is gone. But the lion is there, and so are we. That is what it means. Am Yisrael Chai, the Jews live on.
I love that so much. Uri Kaufman, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And as they say in the old country, Am Yisrael Chai.
Amen. Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you so much.